couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. This week, there's no new movies, but I will be talking about the best and worst of 2023. Plus, I finally got a chance to check out Godzilla Minus One, so I'll talk about that as well. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Doctor Who's Christmas special, The Church on Ruby Road. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Blue Sky or Mastodon, I'm at Kevin Carr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
It was a disappointing weekend last week for Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom. It didn't completely crash and burn, but it didn't do well. It barely made $40 million over the weekend leading into Christmas, and that's less money than the Marvels made, and everybody treated that like it was the worst thing that ever happened. So Aquaman, and the reason Aquaman, I think, kind of flopped is because it's old news now. It's like we're moving into a new universe. Nobody wants to sort of see this stuff from the old universe. It's a lame duck movie, essentially. The thing that was interesting is The Color Purple did phenomenally well on Christmas. It made over $18 million on Christmas, which, by the way, is the second largest Christmas Day opening ever, second only to 2009's Sherlock Holmes by Guy Ritchie. What that goes to show you is movie musicals tend to do well in the Christmas time frame. I mean, if we ignore that whole Cats debacle that happened a couple years ago. But topping the box office for the rest of the Christmas frame was Wonka, which is doing quite well for it being this movie that kind of just fell into Christmas. That's going to be the savior. Now, the only thing that's keeping things good for Warner Brothers is Wonka, Aquaman, and The Color Purple are all three its properties. Migration is somewhere in the second level. It's pretty low for an Illumination movie, but Warner Brothers is going to make some money this weekend and this week, mainly because they just have three movies in the top 10, and that's just a basic release schedule thing. But Aquaman did not do well. Now, the next piece of news is something that's coming up next, or this weekend, actually, on Monday, on January 1st, the original Mickey Mouse cartoon Steamboat Willie goes into public domain. Now, does that mean Mickey Mouse is in public domain? No. First of all, Disney still has a trademark on a lot of stuff with Mickey Mouse. And there's a difference between copyright and trademark. And there's a huge difference. Copyright's something that just kind of arises by law when you create something. You used to have to file for it, but now it's just if you create something, it's copyrighted. Trademark, you actually have to file and go through paperwork and claim and then defend and all that kind of thing. Now, Mickey Mouse, as we know it, is still protected by Disney, but it's just the original short. The image of Mickey Mouse, I'm sure that Disney will sue anybody who starts using Mickey Mouse in a weird way. It's sort of like when Winnie the Pooh went into public domain. The Disney version of Winnie the Pooh was still not just under copyright, but under trademark. And but the original A.A. Milne stories went into public domain, which allowed them to make a movie like, Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey, which was a slasher film where Winnie the Pooh and Piglet go on a murderous rampage. And I saw people saying, oh, don't do that to Steamboat Willie. Well, you know, this is what happens when things go into the public domain. Things happen to stuff. When it's in the public domain, you can do with it whatever you want. That's the definition of the public domain, which leads me to an interesting point. I just sort of stumbled upon this because I saw an article on the internet about it. I talked about It's a Wonderful Life in the Riff Tracks version that I watched this holiday season. And as much as I love that, what's interesting is I found that there's a lot of sites that are playing It's a Wonderful Life, in particular Roku. They have a lot of free stuff on Roku. It's basically a free streaming service that's powered by ads. And they don't want to pay for the actual rights to It's a Wonderful Life. So what they've done is they've replaced the soundtrack, the music, which somebody was able to get their hands on the copyright of that. And that's how they prohibit people from profiting off of It's a Wonderful Life in the traditional sense. what some company did is they got a version of It's a Wonderful Life with the music stripped out, and then they added a new soundtrack, which is just plainly horrible. And I've seen people call, oh, this is terrorism, cinematic terrorism. Again, this is what happens when something's in the public domain. If it's in the public domain, you can use it. And that means you can put whatever garbage music you want. Now, part of the problem is this wasn't done by a great company. This is clearly, like, if we watch, I actually scanned through the version of the film on Roku. And when I got to the end, it had this tag with a studio that apparently puts the music in. But the music's awful because it just sounds like this canned Hallmark music. It's not good. But, you know, you can do that if you take out the copyrighted part. The other thing they did, which is really interesting, I found, is the title cards change. Instead of it being based on The Greatest Gift, which is what the story is, and the people who own the story have gotten litigious on that, they just say it's based on Charles Dickens. And I think they're trying to say, well, it's kind of like the Scrooge story, which it's not. It is demonstratively not that. But I guess they're not going to take that one to court. But this is the thing. Public domain's great because then you have free access to it, but the problem with public domain is anybody can do anything with it, and if somebody's out there trying to gobble up the rights for it, people will find ways around it, and that usually is bad. So as much as I do blame the people who put this awful music in, I blame the people who are still trying to profit off it by pulling a fast one and trying to scoop something out of the public domain. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That song means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is If, which is in theaters on May 17th.
What is happening?
Well, that's a perfectly understandable question given numb.
I'm an if. Get it? Imaginary friend.
Our kids grew up.
So we need new ones.
You could save all of us.
All of who? And don't say ifs.
Let him say it, or I think his head may actually explode.
Fine. Thank you.
I'm really interested to see where this goes, because John Krasinski does have a kind heart to him. And this movie is very different from his sort of his breakthrough as a director, which was A Quiet Place. And as good as that movie was, it was dark. And this one's much more uplifting and looks like it's trying to be fun and kind and sweet and a nice little family film. You know, it's about this father and his daughter who are trying to find homes for these imaginary friends. And it looks cute. The trailer does sound a little bit rough, mainly because you don't get to see the imaginary friend in the trailer, which looks like a giant grimace. So it just sounds annoying. But it looks cute. I'm looking forward to it. I want to see if it can click on the magic or if it's going to be too cheesy. The next one I want to talk about is Axel F, which is coming to Netflix in the summer.
I'm going to be fine. They love me in Beverly Hills.
Detective Foley, you ever read your own file? Shootouts, start of the piece, a lot.
Please tell me you didn't get arrested again.
Twice, but I broke out.
We put our lives on the line every day.
And for what?
Comes with the job if you're doing it right.
This is, of course, the next Beverly Hills Cop movie. It actually looks like it's trying to be more like what the original Beverly Hills Cop film was, rather than that abomination that the third one was. And even the second one was too stylized in Tony Scott's, rest in peace, but too stylized in his own brand. This looks like it's trying to recapture at least a bit of the original. And, you know, I'm curious to see what this comes across as. I mean, you can always do a cop who's been working for ages. So, but it'll be interesting to see if they deal with some of the more, I guess you could say, topical issues with police and how Eddie Murphy bends his humor. Because I am hoping this is a better modern continuation than Coming to America was. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about my worst films of 2023. welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the best and the worst, and I'm going to start with the worst because I'll get that out of the way. I know there's some people who don't like the worst lists. They see it as mean. And what I try to do is I try not to put labors of love on this list. Films that people have you know, like mortgaged our house for. I'm not going after them. I'm going after the studios and the stars who have more than enough money and more than enough backing to make a coherent, solid movie and fail. Just at least it gives me a chance to vent my spleen on some of the crap that I've seen over the last 12 months. And so, without further ado, let's talk about number 5.
Listen to me, Billy. The fate of the world depends on it. The daughters of Atlas are coming for you.
Children stole the power of all the gods. This is very personal, Billy.
Look, I might not have as much experience as you because I'm not super old like you, but I've seen all of the Fast and the Furious movies, lady. It's all about...
Billy! Shazam! That's right, Shazam, Fury of the Gods. Part of the thing is they ruin the character of Billy Batson, which in effect ruins the character of Shazam. Even as much as Billy Batson, the actor, the kid who plays Billy Batson, has gotten older and matured and plays a more mature Billy Batson, Zachary Levi has gotten more juvenile and silly and stupid. So this movie was terrible, but what made it even worse was his insane moronic defense going on social media and begging, literally begging people to see this movie and accusing people who didn't like it of subterfuge. Now, number 4.
It's been around forever.
Hidden. In the dark. It's like all those spooky monsters you think are hiding under your bed.
What is this? It's the thing that comes for your kids when you're not paying attention.
You believe me? Don't you?
As much as I love Stephen King, and I love his work, and I remember reading this story when I was a kid, The Boogeyman was a mess of a movie. One of the tropes that we're seeing a lot is horror being a symbol of trauma and grief. And that works, and that's nothing new in horror. It's just it's a little heavy-handed now. Now, the biggest problem with this movie, though, is while it wasn't a great version of the story, it was impossible to see. It was the darkest shot movie, and things were very difficult to discern at times, and they didn't light people right. That's a trend right now, and it's awful. So that's number 4. Now, number 3.
What makes total strangers pull off an elaborate bank heist? Are you familiar with the concept of hypnotics?
Hypnotics.
Hypnotics have the ability to influence the brain. Sound. Voice.
Need a light?
Locking eyes. Hypnotics use them to make you see a version of the world that doesn't exist.
Next.
It's not him anymore.
Next, stop!
Hypnotic. This was directed by Robert Rodriguez, and it's basically him trying to do Inception, but making a very, very dumb version of it. And look, I like a good sort of mind mess movie like this, but this movie at times was incoherent, and it shows a gross misunderstanding of actually how intelligent your average viewer can be. In the number 2 spot, we have this one for the ladies. So let's
dance, Why are you in London?
I'm going to put on a show at this famous theater.
People are numb, disconnected. We're going to wake them up with a wave of passion they've never felt before.
Without further ado, I give you the visionary artist's magic mind.
So...
the real question is, why do you love her?
No one's believed in me like your mom has.
That's right, Magic Mike's Last Dance. Did you forget that there was a Magic Mike movie this year? I actually did. It wasn't until I was going through and looking at all the releases of 2023 that I'm like, oh my god, that crap came out this year. Look, I know I'm not the target market for the Magic Mike movies. I mean, obviously, I'm not. If I'm going to spend my time on the internet looking at jumbly bits, it's going to be different versions of those. but I've never really liked the Magic Mike movies, mainly because I don't like the characters. In the first movie, I thought his story was interesting, but the love interest, she was awful. And it's because she's this actress who was the Nepo baby. She's the daughter of some producer. This one was just an absolute mess. It was incoherent. It tried to be like this old Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland, hey guys, let's put on a show type movie. And it doesn't make any sense. It sort of like took the premise of Burlesque with Christina Aguilera, like what was that, like 15 years ago, which was actually quite a fun movie. And it just did it in a very ill-constructed way. Magic Mike's Last Dance was awful. And that leads us into number one, which is the worst movie of 2023 for me.
Young Max, one more offense and you'll be behind bars. Flora, you're his mother. Find him something to do.
You are a great mother.
Am I? Happy birthday.
What's that?
It's yours.
Don't want to play. Since when am I a guitarist?
I can't go on like this, living in a shoebox with a kid who hates me.
So, you want to learn the guitar? This is a gift you can take to your grave.
What's your problem?
I didn't know I had a problem.
You're teaching guitar online, love.
This one not everybody saw. It's called Flora and Son, and it's from Apple TV Plus, so that's why I consider it ripe for the picking. And look, Apple TV Plus has put out some good content this year, just not this one. It's directed by the guy and written by the guy who did Once. And I never liked Once, but this one, it had a lot of the same themes of this woman trying to learn music and kind of having this bonding moment with her son, but their music was garbage. And you had Joseph Gordon-Levitt playing this. He's basically a music teacher over the internet, teaching him how to play guitar. And he is such a gatekeeper with music. Like, he asks her at one point what her favorite song was, and she's like, "It's Beautiful." And then he proceeds to berate her for that choice, and then doesn't berate her for the garbage that they put out. This movie, a lot of people loved it. I did not. I hated it. It was the worst movie of the year for me. And finally, let's throw in this dishonorable mention. I always like to throw one little last one in there. A movie that didn't quite make the top five, but came pretty close.
The Demeter, on charter from Romania to London, shipping private crates out at sea with no land in sight.
Something ripped apart the animals.
All the livestock?
This looks like a bite.
Search the ship everywhere.
In the night, it drinks our blood. He is here. We call him Dracula.
As much as I love horror movies, very much like The Boogeyman, The Last Voyage of the Demeter was a misfire of colossal proportions. I love the Dracula story. I love the idea of this movie of going back to the ship that brought Dracula over, which is this relatively small part of the book, but it has a really great idea. But it was shot so murky and dark, you couldn't see anything. And then there was so much CGI, it just looked like crap. This movie was a great idea and just never quite came together because it made all the mistakes that trendy filmmaking does rather than good filmmaking. And that's it, my worst of the year for 2023. Coming back on the other side of the break, I'm going to be talking about the best of 2023. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Well, I talked about my worst films of 2023, and let's talk about my best films of 2023. Now, you got to remember, everything in film criticism and art is subjective. That's the nature of the beast. This is not a definitive list of what is actually objectively good or bad. It's 100% subjective. It's my opinion. Now, what's interesting about this year is usually I get to the end of the year and I have a list of films, three or four films that I'm like, these are just definitively my favorite ones. But what's interesting is I didn't have that reaction to very many films this year. Actually, almost none. Every single movie that I really enjoyed came with a Kim Kardashian. it came with a big but. So, like, it didn't even make my list, but, you know, something like the Mission Impossible movie. That was a good, solid action movie, but it was half of one. I don't like that splitting it up in two parts. And it was like 3 hours long. Most movies that have came out this year were way too long and should not have been as long as they were. So there's a lot of movies that I really liked, or like Poor Things. I really enjoyed Poor Things. I thought that was a neat movie, but I think it had some messaging issues that it sort of copped out on and didn't fully address. But let's move on, and we'll talk about my five favorite movies of 2023. In the fifth place.
Hi, Barbie.
Hi, Barbie.
Hi, Barbie.
Hi, Barbie.
Hi, Barbie.
Hi, Barbie.
Hi, Ken.
Hi, Ken.
Put the radio fast and goes cruising just as fast as she can now.
I thought I might stay over tonight.
Why?
Because we're girlfriend boyfriend.
To do what?
I'm actually not sure.
What are you doing here?
I'm coming with you.
Did you bring your rollerblades?
I literally go nowhere without them.
Now, here's what's interesting. I was not a huge fan of Barbie when it came out, but I cannot deny the phenomenon it had. And you go back and you look at it and go, you know what? This was a movie with a lot of heart. This was a movie that, look, you take an underrepresented audience and you make a movie for them and you're going to make a lot of money on it. And I love the fact that it became this social event. And I felt that about movies like Avatar back in 2009, also Paranormal Activity back in 2009. I love the effect and the interest that it drew. Number four.
If summer doesn't sing in you, then nothing sings in you. And if nothing sings in you, then you can't make music. Something she told me.
Hello, I'm Lenny.
Hello, Felicia.
He can be the first great American conductor.
There's a price for being in my brother's orbit, you know that.
Maestro is a beautiful film. It is one of the most well-constructed movies I've seen this year. From the cinematography, to the music, to the sound mix, to the acting, to even the makeup. I thought the makeup was done very, very well for as much as they used to sort of like move around some things and time-wise. Maestro was not necessarily a movie that I'm going to just watch over and over and over again, but it is just amazingly put together. And it shows that Bradley Cooper's not just a flash in the pan. I wasn't a huge fan of A Star Is Born, but I respected the work. And here he took it farther. He did some things where he did a great job directing this movie. So Maestro, that's why it's at number four. Number three.
Well, we mix these families together, and that estate money flows the right direction. It'll come to us.
Shomikasi, that's how you are.
I don't know what you said, but it must have been Indian for handsome devil.
Why did you come here?
I work with my uncle.
You scared of him?
Oh, he's the nicest man in the world.
I'm a big Scorsese fan. I don't like all of his movies. This is one that had the big butt of it being too long. But then again, that's Scorsese's movies. I mean, The Irishman was about the same length. And while this is a bit of a chore to sit through all at once, and I'll be interested to see how Apple TV Plus reconciles it when it puts it on its service, whether it breaks it up the way Netflix did with The Irishman or not. But for a movie that was close to 4 hours, it moved. And I did not feel like I was getting dragged down or bored with it. I thought it was just a very well-done movie that told a fantastic story, and it took its time. It didn't spoon-feed it to the audience, but it also made sure that the audience got the point. Number two, this is kind of a surprise for some people.
Put your hand on it. Now say, talk to me.
What did the hand feel like?
It felt amazing. I could see and feel everything on the other side. Still been saying stuff.
You mean saying stuff?
What if we opened the door but we didn't shut it?
I love horror movies, and this was, I thought, very innovative. And while it does play around with that trope of grief equals horror elements, Talk to Me was a new version of a slasher movie, because essentially at its core, Talk to Me is what any good slasher movie is, a bunch of stupid kids doing stupid things because they think they're indestructible. And so it plays off of that, but there's something deeper going on in there. And it's not just raw trauma that it's trying to deconstruct. It's not just throwing it on the screen. It's people trying to figure out how to get around something and how to fix something, how to close that barn door once the horses are out, you know, proverbially speaking. I really enjoyed this one. It's a neat little, you know, fringe film from Australia or New Zealand, actually. And it's worth checking out. And at number one, my number one favorite movie of 2023.
You're not here.
We're not there. The car exploded.
Where are you?
Asteroid City, Farm Route 6, mile 75.
What do those pulses indicate?
What? Oh, the beeps and blips? We don't know.
Some of our information about outer space may no longer be completely accurate. Anyway, there's still only 9 planets in the solar system as far as we know, Billy?
Except now there's an alien.
I don't like the way that guy looked at us. The alien.
How did he look?
Like we're doomed.
Maybe we are.
Look, if you haven't learned by now, I'm a huge Wes Anderson fan, then you haven't been listening to the show. I do love Wes Anderson stuff. I love the fact that he did all these little short films on Netflix as well. But Asteroid City, it's quintessential peak Wes Anderson. Now, what's interesting is his last film, The French Dispatch, I didn't like that much. It was almost too quirky. And while this one was certainly quirky, it was a little bit more digestible. And I really liked it in that sense. I've always liked his style and I've always liked his delivery. And I think this managed to do the silly stuff and the fun stuff while at the same time looking at history and paranoia and what you can believe that the government says and what you can't and how people will react in all these different situations while at the same time mirroring it with their actions in interpersonal relationships. That's my top five of 2023. My honorable mention.
I don't believe in magic. A few times in my life, I've seen things I can't explain, and I've come to believe it's not so much what you believe, it's how hard you believe it.
That's right, Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. I talked about this a couple weeks ago because it came out on 4K. Definitely worth getting. I know it was a divisive movie. Same thing that happened with the last Indiana Jones film. I think people want Raiders of the Lost Ark, but you're not going to get it because Harrison Ford's not the same person that he was. He's not the same character. The character has to grow, and you have to put it in a different decade. Otherwise, you got an 80-year-old guy running around as a 30-year-old guy would be doing. But I really enjoyed this Indiana Jones movie. I thought it was a nice throwback to the original flavor and style. And James Mangold certainly managed to capture a Spielbergian feel to it. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Godzilla Minus One and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Doctor Who, the Christmas special. You're the best around. Nothing's gonna ever keep. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about one movie that I finally got a chance to check out. This is my sort of my catch-up time. So I decided to check out Godzilla Minus One, which I'm a member of the Critics' Choice Association, and this one is nominated for Best Foreign Language Film. Godzilla Minus One, as World War II comes to a close, Japan faces extinction by a massive nuclear-powered monster from the sea. Now, before I play the trailer, I just got to warn you, it's in Japanese. I can't really play unfiltered Japanese. I don't know what it says in Japanese. It could be swear words for all I know, and it just translates differently as subtitles, but you can't see subtitles on the radio. But I do have clips of the movie. It just has no dialogue to it. So I'll describe it for you as we go through. Okay, so yeah, here, that's Godzilla's roar. There is. Okay, he's attacking. He's destroying something. There's a lot of people screaming. People are dying. Okay. You stepped on somebody there. There you go. It's Godzilla. That's what he does. This is the latest Godzilla movie, and one of the things the Japanese do, Toho, which is the company that puts together the Japanese films, they've been making Godzilla movies since the 50s. And the first movie has some cheesy elements to it, but ultimately it's a serious disaster film. It's a guy in a rubber suit, sure. But it was the 1950s. I know I've seen the original Japanese version of Godzilla, and I've seen the American version where they get Raymond Burr playing his name's Steve Martin. That's the character's name in the movie. And he reports on it. And I've seen both versions, and they both serve their own purposes culturally. But, you know, you get this point where you're in the middle of the 70s, and there's some real cheesy stuff going on. And we've all seen Mystery Science Theater, and they love those kaiju movies, the big rubber monster suits, the Godzilla, Gamera, all that kind of stuff. But somewhere in the 1990s, Toho started making better, serious Japanese Godzilla movies, and some of them are quite good. And some of these kaiju movies are good because one of the things that the Japanese do is kaiju is just kind of part of their culture. We get a big monster movie every couple of years or, you know, maybe once a year, but it's not cultural for us. This is a cultural thing. Kaiju show up in mythology and there's legends and everything. And the kaiju movie in Japan is more of a conduit to bring across real issues. Now, they kind of lost sight of that in the 70s, and it gets goofy rubber monster stuff. But once they started making some of these movies in like the 90s and into the 2000s, they do some really serious work. And one of the things with this movie is it's about Japan in post-World War II. And the fact that Japan was just decimated and just leveled. So it was at zero. And then Godzilla shows up and it makes it less than zero. And Godzilla's not in the movie all that much. Most of the movie's about survivorship guilt and bravery and cowardice and doing the right thing and, you know, when you're fighting for your country and when you're on a suicide mission and understanding that, because one of the whole subplots is there's a character in there where he was a kamikaze pilot and he fled the mission because he felt it was a pointless mission. It was, they weren't going to win even with the kamikaze attack. So he feigned mechanical problems. So he's dealing with that, and he's dealing with guilt, and he's dealing with coming back and picking up the pieces and forging a family. So that stuff's interesting. It does get a little overwrought. And part of that's, I think, just the acting in a film like this. But overall, I mean, it's a good movie. I think it's well done. What I find fascinating is they didn't release a dubbed version of this. And look, I know the sub versus dub argument. And I think it's one of the most elitist gatekeeping arguments you've ever seen. Look, I'm all for it if you say, I want to see a subtitle version of a movie. But why should you, your desire, stop people from seeing a dubbed version of a movie? Oh, well, if you can't read, what if you can't? I've heard stories of people like the kids have a kid who loves Godzilla, but can't read fast enough to understand what's going on. What about them? What about somebody who has glaucoma or some other vision issue that makes it very hard to focus on the words and the action? How do you do that? What about, I have a friend who's blind. He's legally blind. How's he supposed, he doesn't speak Japanese. How's he supposed to enjoy Godzilla? I mean, here's the thing. I am all for more options for watching. I don't think anyone gets to dictate how somebody should watch something. And I think it's stupid and elitist and quite frankly mean-spirited to not include a dubbed version and then say, oh, you're lazy. Learn to read. I know you need to read. No, there's some people who can't. Or what about just personal preference? Nobody's making you have to watch a dubbed version. Just make it available. Do you know how much it costs to do a dubbing of a movie like a Godzilla film? Probably $10,000 at the most. That's like, what, for a minute of footage of Godzilla? Look, it is super cheap to do. Just put it out there. And I hate that thing of saying, I like to watch it subtitled, so you must. And I find that horrible and exclusive to people. So, and I mean, it's an interesting spin on the carnage and devastation of the kaiju, though it does get a bit overworked emotionally. It wrings its hands a lot. But still, I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. I teased this a couple weeks ago because they're doing all the specials from Doctor Who, and they David Tennant, well, he didn't regenerate, he bigenerated, because there's apparently like two Doctors now. But I figure this is Shutigatwa's first solo venture as the Doctor, so let's take a look at this, and dropped on Christmas Day. Doctor Who, The Church on Ruby Road. In this new incarnation, the Doctor comes across a teenager from London who is being pursued across time by goblins.
Let me sit you down and tell you a Christmas story. A story of chance, coincidence, and luck.
Who are you?
Merry Christmas.
I'm the Doctor.
What's up there?
Goblins.
Hiya.
Time travelers are great.
The biggest news of this one is that it's Shutigatwa's first sort of solo outing. And I couldn't quite judge him as an actor in the last special, Giggle, because he was sharing the screen with David Tennant. And David Tennant is so beloved and had played him for so long and has come back to the role a couple times. And I thought Gatwa did a good job. And there's something about Gatwa that I really, really like that I think's kind of been missing, even with Tennant and Smith, who were sort of the whimsical characters. There's a kindness in Gatwa's delivery. There's something about him in just that tail end of that last special and in this special. He's the kind of person that would come up to you and would just give you a hug. I don't get that from any of the recent Doctors, or really any of them. Certainly not Peter Capaldi. And Jodie Whittaker, hers was a little more manic. Tennant and Smith had this almost I'm talking down to you edge, but there's a real sort of sweetness that Shutigatwa has that I did enjoy. And I like this one. This reminded me of some of the earlier starts to new companions and new Doctors, like the first ones with Amy Pond, with Karen Gillan and Matt Smith, or even maybe not the first ones with Rose and David Eccleston, but the ones with Rose and David Tennant. I think that there's, as much as it could be seen as I want to have a romantic fling with a Doctor, and that's become overdone now. They did that a lot with the Jodie Whittaker and the character of Yaz, and they did that with Matt Smith and Clara, and they did that with David Tennant and Rose for sure. That's one of the reasons I like Donna Noble and Fariima Adjaman as Martha Jones, because they were never interested in sleeping with a Doctor. So there seems to be this, I'm your friend, and I'll give you a hug, but we're going on an adventure too. So I did enjoy this Doctor Who. I felt it was kind of a throwback to some of the earlier ones we had about 10 years ago or more, and I'm curious to continue. I just hope, please don't have him sing in every episode. That will get old so fast. I can't do too much more of them singing. So it's not perfect, but it's a nice step forward into a new era with an element of kindness that sometimes gets lost in the show's spectacle. I'm going to say that The Church on Ruby Road rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about a whole new year with Night Swim. Until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.